Okay, today is March 27th, 2018. We're here inside the Cole Center. This is an oral history interview with Rashard Griffith. My name is Troy Reeves with the UW-Mass Oral History Program. Rashard, to help me with the sound quality, can you say your name and spell your last name?
First name, Rashard Griffith. G-R-I-F-F-I-T-H.
Okay, great. I'm going to get this table just a little closer to you, maybe. Okay, so as I said before I turn this on, Rashard, the first question is a big, broad one. It's like, what brought you here to UW-Madison to play basketball?
Well, during my college decision-making, I was going to choose a school that wasn't that far. I got recruited by Georgetown, Duke, Carolina, schools from, you know, far out east and far south. But we had Tracy Webster, Michael Finley, and Howard Moore, all guys who I knew from Chicago playing basketball. And then, of course, Stu Jackson was the pretty much deciding factor because he had just left the Knicks from head coaching them and coaching one of the best big men at the time, Patrick Ewing. And so by me being a big man and him coaching, and I seen how he got Pat the ball in their system, and it was one of the Knicks' better franchise years. It sold me. And plus, on that note too, I like challenges, and I know the Badgers hadn't been back to the NCAA tournament in 47 years. I come from, since I was in grammar school, winning programs with success following me, because that's just me. I mean, I'm a competitor. I like to compete. So I would say my decision was based on I knew them, those three, Mike, Howard, and Trey Webb, and Coach Jackson. And I like to throw in there that when I was here, it made me feel at home, family atmosphere. Unlike the other visits that I took, it was more of a family atmosphere, and I'm a family type of guy.
So would you mind talking a little bit about how you became interested in basketball anyway?
Yeah. It started in... Started from, I'll say, the time I was in fifth grade. My coach, my grammar school coach and gym teacher at the time, Coach Benny Parrott, he was always on me about, trying to play basketball or do something. I would just go to gym and I would just participate in the stuff just so I can get a passing grade. And sports didn't interest me. I was a kid, but I was always tall. So I was in... It's my seventh grade year. I was 6'5". And Coach Parrott was like, sixth grade year. And he was like, just try to play basketball. Just give it a shot. So I started trying. Of course, I was uncoordinated, awkward. I was tall and skinny. But I started getting better. So as I got better, I wanted to do more. So he enrolled me in a camp at UIC, University of North Chicago, for the summer for my seventh grade year. And so I pretty much played ball all that summer. And from that summer, I went down with my father. After the camps and stuff, I went down with my father to Atlanta. And this was going into my eighth grade year. And I shot from 6'5 to 6'9. Over the course of the summer, so I didn't realize I had grew so fast. So the judgment came from when I put my clothes on, because everything was short. And so my father had this phrase that he said, "What your feet doing? Eating the doggone shoes up?" I mean, he said, "Man, I just bought you a pair last week." And so I never forget him saying that to me. And it was a learning experience for me down there, because even though my father didn't play basketball, he knew some moves. And he was doing the same move on me, and I could never beat him. For whatever reason, I could never beat him. So it was all me. That's when my competition, my drive came out. And so I got back to Chicago, and I was determined to be able to dunk and to be better than my father, or no one else would ever beat me in a one-on-one or anything like that. So I went from, in one year, about a year and a half time, I went from not being known to One day in my eighth grade year, my whole life changed. I walked into school. The principal, Dr. Temple, she pulled me into her office, and I was in the Chicago Sun-Times, and had a picture of Michael Jordan and me. And I was leaning, we had a poster, a life-size poster of Michael Jordan, and it had me leaning against the poster with him, and said Chicago's finest, and talking about how I was this eighth grade phenomena, and because I think I just had a game where I scored 60 points, and I didn't know, and then the first thing that Coach Perry told me after that happened, he said, "You just had your first brush with exploitation," because of the my principal had me sign a stack of newspapers that was taller than her desk. And this had me, that was my first autograph session and everything. I didn't know what was going on. He explained everything to me and told me that now, because of that situation with me being put in the paper and all this stuff, the rules that apply to me growing up with my friends and stuff, doing silly stuff or maybe wanting to get in trouble, don't apply to me. Never knew what he was saying. Understood what he was saying. I'm 13 years old. So I just wanted to play ball because I started getting better at it. And then the recruitment started coming from high schools. He was my grammar school coach, but he was also the Froshoff coach and assistant coach for King High School, the high school I went to. I didn't know where I was going to go to high school at. So I had Percy L. Julian was in my district. That's where I lived at the time. And so Coach Cox would come pick me up in the morning and take me to school. So I was practicing with Froshoff the majority of the time until one day Coach Cox was like, "Hey, yo, Benny, send them on down here. I wanted to practice with the varsity." I went and played with the varsity, and I never went back. And I didn't even know I was going to start. First game of the season, Coach, they called my name starting at center. And I'm a freshman, and it was a senior that was Damian Porter, was 6'10 and 270. I'm 6'9, 6'10, don't even weigh 200 pounds. But I was in the starting lineup on the number one team in the country. With two All-Americans, four guys getting ready to go to Division I college, play Division I college basketball. I was the lone freshman out there playing. And it was a unique experience. And I learned things, but my childhood was abruptly ended when I was in my eighth grade year, 13. So I never had a birthday party. Everything I did was surrounded by basketball, traveling here, traveling there, et cetera. So basketball consumed my life. So that's how I got better. I was just playing. There was no one to tell me like what my passion is, what it is right now today, because I want to help people to steer them in the right directions and learn to, I listened to my mother and father, but my mother didn't know about sports. My father didn't know about sports like that. So this was just all on me. Mm-hmm. And I had to learn pretty much trial by fire. Threw me out there. Through God's grace and mercy, I survived.
So, King High School, is that where you ended up going to?
Mm-hmm.
So, who else was on that starting five then?
Okay, starting five. Jamie Brandon, who was eventually that year Mr. Basketball Illinois, so that's the top player in the state. Johnny Selby, starting power forward, he went to New Mexico State, 6'8", 250 in high school. Amal Sharif, our small forward, went to Pittsburgh. Keith Johnson, who went to Northern Illinois, as our 6'5 star point guard, and I was the lone center.
So, starting in eighth grade, well, you said you did, you went to Atlanta, but did you, well, I'll just ask it because you mentioned it before we started the recording, you participated in AAU?
That didn't happen to my, that happened in my sophomore and junior year in high school.
Okay.
I played AAU ball. It wasn't like it is right now. It was literally the best 15 players from the state. This one team that represented Chicago. And it was the best 15, for instance, like this. Besides myself, Thomas Hamilton, my teammate, you had Antoine Walker, you had Chris Collins. Mm-hmm. You had these guys all on one team playing, and we went to Both times we went to Las Vegas for a Nike Invitational AAU Summer League games.
Okay.
That's when we've been at it for like a week.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so that was later in your high school?
That was my sophomore and junior year. My senior year, I signed my letter of intent to come to Wisconsin my junior year, because the recruitment process for me was different than a lot of people. They're doing it now more frequently, but I'm one of the first that was it started with. My eighth grade year, John Thompson, Bobby Knight, I want to say Rick Pitino, they came to watch me play in eighth grade. I didn't know who they were. I didn't know what was going on. They heard about this eighth grader, John, and they had to come see for themselves. So one day at a game, they were sitting in the corner, and I'm looking at all these cameras flashing and stuff like that or whatever. I don't know what's going on. I'm just playing ball. Until I got older, I realized that they were there. And all the phone calls and stuff that I was getting, my mother was getting, stemmed from that. So it started when I was in eighth grade, my recruitment for college, but also high school recruited me. So because I didn't go to Julian that was in my district, they called the Board of Education and told the Board of Education that I lived in their district, which was true. I lived in their district, and that so I should be going to their school. So they thought because that if I went to their school that I would play ball, but I wouldn't have because of what they did. Then moved because of basketball, moved from there to Eisenhower, suburbs. Same thing. Eisenhower found out, they did the same thing. So that's what took me and got me and my family to live in the projects. So for me, because I was going to King to live in that district, we lived in Ida B. Wells. So now I'm in Ida B. Wells. My family went from living in a home to projects because of basketball, because of me.
So that, I mean, sounds like a lot of sacrifice for your parents to do that.
It was just my mother, because even though my mother and father got divorced when I was young, but my father stayed in. He was still in our life.
Okay.
He was still in our life. The summers we spent with him, that was either in Joliet until he moved to Atlanta, then we would go to Atlanta. But that was our time with our father, the summer. And, you know, we would talk to him on the weekends and stuff like that. And he supported us. And, you know, my mother was the one that was taking me to dropping me off at practice and picking me up until I was able to drive. And did these things on my own, but it took a lot of sacrifice from my mother, because she was the one that had to move. And when, you know, she didn't know what was going on, and she was just looking at me, and she was like, if this is what you want to do, then we got to find. She's like, if you don't want to transfer and go to them school, I said, I'm not. And I said, if I transfer from King and go to them schools, I'm not going to play ball, because I'm not going to go play for that team. My goal was, I knew Coach Perry, he's the one that got me to start playing basketball. He's at King. That's what I want to be. Mm-hmm. And that's what it came down to. So she was like, well, that's what you want to do. I'll find a solution. So she found a solution.
Okay. So you've talked about a couple of people in your life. I want to ask directly, as you were growing up here and as basketball became your life, who were some of your mentors? Who were some people who helped you through that period?
Well, Coach Parrott, Benny Parrott, for one, he was the first and foremost, because he's the one that got me started. He was there. He's still there today. He just let me know how things were going to go, how things were going to be. And I didn't really have, I mean, as far as basketball, that was pretty much my only mentor when I was growing up, because Coach Cox, he's different. Everybody do things in a different way. He was just the coach. You know what I'm saying? He had the greatest show in Chicago, as he quote unquote said, or whatever. Every gym we went to was standing room only. So that NBA lifestyle, I lived that in high school. I mean, we walking outside the locker room, wherever we went, crowds and stuff like that, all that stuff. The gym's packed, fire marshals coming in. I don't care if it's our gym or a road game. That's how it was. And now I found out stuff that, you know, as I got older, that, you know, for tournaments and stuff like that, that, you know, Cox was getting, you know, he can charge people anywhere up from $6,000, $7,000 at the gate or whatever, because he knew we were an attraction. for that, where we went to. And we went to Danville Thanksgiving Tournament. He knew that we were going to be the attraction there. So he was like, look, if you want my team to come, this is how much I'm going to need for blah, blah, blah. We always were draped in Nike, the freshest, newest, whatever, uniforms, jogging suits. He kept us in nice stuff, but and all we had to do was go out there and play, which all we wanted to do was play. Right. That was our way out. That was my way out. Basketball was my way of staying out of trouble, and it was my way of getting us out of poverty and taking myself to another level.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's talk about maybe the next step in that other level then is coming to school here. Mm-hmm. So you said you signed your letter of intent junior year.
Yep.
Do you recall your first trip here?
You know, my first trip here, let me see, I'm trying to think. Yeah, I forgot which game it was. I want to say it was the Michigan game. See, Webb, when we played Michigan here in the field house.
Okay.
That was the first game that I had. I came to a football game. I came to that game, the Michigan game. And then I went to a game in Chicago. Actually, Stu Jackson's first game when they lost against Loyola. I don't know if you remember that one. Mm-mm. It was in Chicago, and they lost against Loyola. Mm-hmm. So he was quite upset about that. And I was there, too, when we lost. And you know, we had lost the game. But who was a stick, you know, always in my mind is because Coach Ray McCollum, that's who recruited me. So that was the main guy that I seen all the times at my games in the stands and stuff like that. I always seen Ray with a red or a white shirt with, you know, the Wisconsin on it or whatever. So I always seen Coach Ray in the stands on the road trips and stuff like that. I always seen him there looking at me. But that recruiting process for me was just tiresome. My mother got to the point where she was like, you know what? I am truly tired of all these people calling my house. And she let the process, it was completely up to me. She said, you can go wherever you want. She just didn't want me. She told me only one school was off limits, and that's Illinois, University of Illinois. And that's because whatever she had heard about Cox having a relationship with University of Illinois, she didn't, and all the players that went there, majority of them, it didn't work out, their mm-hmm. careers and their lives. She was like, he's not going to be involved in his recruitment, and he's not going to University of Illinois. She was like, anything else, wherever you want to go, I will come. She was like, you can go wherever you want, but not there. That's the only thing she said to me about my recruitment. Hmm.
Was this still the time where you get letters from?
I had garbage bags full of letters. The majority of them I never opened up. She would look through some of them or whatnot. I was still a kid. I just wanted to go to school, play ball. Mm-hmm. That was it. And when I finally figured out and realized, okay, you know what? I knew my mother was getting tired of it, that I needed to take care of this, get this done. That's when I sat down and I started looking at you know, teams real more on TV, following certain teams, then narrowing it down, saying, okay, Mom, are you going to be coming to the games? She was just like, yeah, but, you know, I mean, it's easy for me if I can drive there, you know, a few hours, 3, 4, 5 hours, something like that, or whatever. I got your uncle and my father, you know, your father, they'll come with me or whatever, your brother. My sister was off. She was, you know, married with kids and stuff. So she didn't do too much, you know, partake in basketball or stuff like that or whatever. She just supported me. So she was just like, yeah. So I was like, okay, so now that narrows off these schools, you know, going out to Duke, going out to here or whatever, because she said that they would try to come there every game, which they pretty much did. Mm-hmm. So that was that narrowed it down. So it was Purdue, Wisconsin, Ohio State. Those were pretty much my three teams that I was going to. It was three schools that I was going to choose. So I didn't go on an official visit to Ohio State, but I went to an official visit here, and I went to an official visit at Purdue. And that was it. And then I went to those two or whatever. Kentucky came into the house. All the other schools came down. Ida B. Wells, so they came to the projects and, you know, visited me and sat down and stuff like that or whatever. But I knew I wasn't, I knew I wasn't going far away.
So, since we don't know who will listen to this, can you talk a little bit about why the visits to Wisconsin and Purdue had to be quote unquote official visits?
Well, no, that's what you get. So, you can get an unofficial visit and you can get an official visit. Official visit just means that the university, you coming up and the university is taking care of everything. Unofficial visit, like if you were my father and this was an unofficial visit, you can come in the locker room, you know, it's on your time. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to show, we're not going to go see everything. We're not going to go meet the academic people. We're not going to go meet Miss Mary and talk about school and what it takes to get in. That's an unofficial visit. Official visit is when you come and we're taking you, you're going to see everything. Mm-hmm. You're going to go talk about academics. You're going to go meet the athletic director. You're going to meet the chancellor. You're going to meet everybody who's going to be part of your molding you become a young man and helping you through your 4 or 5 years while you're here at the University of Wisconsin.
Okay. So then after high school, did you come here that summer?
The SOAR program.
Okay.
I came to the SOAR program. Yep, I was here. School was over with. I was right to the SOAR program.
What are your thoughts or memories of that first summer in the SOAR program?
For me, it was an easy transition, and the reason being is because when we were playing high school ball, we would be put into a camp with 150, 200 players, and you at this camp for a week. And that's pretty much how college was, with people who you don't know. Some you know if they're invited from your team and stuff like that. And, you know, then we had team camps where our whole team went to BC camp or whatever was a team camp. And we would go down there. Then Nike camp was this invitation on 150 of the top players from around the country. And Big Tommy was with me. That was my roommate. So that was cool. But then you pass some people. So I'm in camp like with Rasheed Wallace, Joe Smith, Jason Kidd before he left, and you know all these guys or whatever. So you got the old, you got from the young. I was from my freshman year on. I was at this camp for 4 years. So I'm seeing these guys as they're come to see Webbs and the Jalen Roses and everybody, et cetera, et cetera. So I seen these guys, and we all out there competing against each other, playing ball. You know what I'm saying? Trying to be ranked wherever in our class, and you know for future rankings and stuff like that. So that's what wound up happening, and that prepared me for college. So now I was used to being around people that I didn't know, and meeting new people, and you know, color not being an option or whatever. Because I had people ask me before, they're like, "You go to that school?" And this all, I said, "I don't have a problem with that. That's not a problem for me." Mm-hmm. Unless people make that's that probably that person's problem, but it's not a problem for me. I'm going here to go to school, and ever since I came to Wisconsin, it's totally different. Even though Chicago is just 2 hours away, it's night and day difference between the culture, the atmosphere, and how people treat you and the way that things are done up here. Mm-hmm. And that's why I say Chicago, I was born there, it raised me, but Wisconsin molded me, and this fits me to a T because I'm a family man. Even when I played professional, when I was overseas and stuff like that, I kept to myself. I go to practice, I go home. I'm not a party person. I'm an indoors type of person. If I can have my house and everything that I need in my house, I ain't gotta go outside. That's just me though. Mm-hmm. And like I said, it probably comes from the things that I've been through early in life, being thrust into the media limelight, and not being able to do everything that everybody else per se did when I was growing up. And I didn't think about it. It didn't bother me. I'm like, you know what, whatever. But then as I got older and I had my own kids, I see the stuff that I missed.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah, so it's like, okay, cool. Don't cry over spilled milk. Now it's about them, so.
Right. So where did you end up living that first year or on campus?
I was in the Regent for my 2 years here.
You were where?
The Regent.
The Regent.
Yep, yep. Okay. The Regent, yep.
So when you got here and started taking classes in the fall, how did college classes compare to the classes you were taking in high school?
The work world was a little bit more, but the major thing that I noticed was that you had more time on your hands. And that's college life. That's how people. I can see now how so many people flunk out of college. It's because if you're a party person, and I've seen it happen, if you're a party person or a person that likes to live that life and stuff like that, be outside and out and about, then you out there, you're too tired to sit up there and come in after you had a whole night of partying and drinking and doing whatever to come in and get your homework done. Let's do it 11 o'clock the next morning. Mm-hmm. So you have to manage your time. But you're young, you're an adult. you have to manage your time. It's all about time management now. You get your paperwork done, you get whatever work you need to get it done, and then you can go out and do whatever. See, but basketball, sports, I think the athletes are at a unique advantage because everything for us is pretty much scheduled out. From our classes to when they start to when they end because we have practice. To having a grade point average in order for you to be eligible to play. So that works out for us. That helps us out. If you stay on top of your stuff to get the tutors that you need, the help that you need to make sure you're on top and pass your classes. And this being part of that family. I mean, this is a family. I mean, this is our culture. Wisconsin's our school, but overall, we're a family. The brother, the person to your right, the person to your left, and the front and the back of you, those are your brothers. You need to understand. And that was what was told to me when I came here by, you know, Mike and by Howard and by Trey Webb. Family. And you can see right now to this day, we are still family. Mm-hmm. You know, Coach Moore, that's my brother. You know what I'm saying? Trey Webb, he's still here. Mike Finley's comes around, still coming around. Coach Alvarez, I didn't even play football, but Coach Alvarez is like a father to me. Mm-hmm. So it's just like, I'm still in contact with Stu Jackson. I'm still in contact with Stan Van Gundy. Family, and all that stems from here.
So you've mentioned three of the players that were here when you got here. Mm-hmm. So who are some of the other players that were here when you started that first year?
My first year, we had Brian Kelly, Otto McDuffie, Jeff Peterson. Who else? I'm trying to think. Who else was here? Those are the main ones that I remember right now.
And you had said earlier that one of the reasons why you came here, I don't remember whether we got down the court or not, I probably did, was that it had been a while since Wisconsin had been in the tournament.
It was 47 years since they had been in the tournament. I did my research, and it was a challenge, and I looked for the challenge. You know, Stu put the challenge out there once. And I mean, that's part of recruiting. Once he got to know what kind of person I was, and I knew that I liked the challenges and stuff like that, to challenge myself to see how good I really am, then that was one of the things he laid out there for me. He said, are you that person to come and get that monkey off our backs at Wisconsin to get us back to the tournament? Are you that missing piece? Well, that's only one way to find out. Come join us and let's see.
And then practice started that sometime during that fall semester.
And actually for us, I think, if I'm not mistaken, we started weights and stuff during the summer when I was in the SOAR program to get acclimated. And I remember that because it was my first time ever lifting weights. And we were doing curls. And my arms swole up so big, I could not straighten my arms out for a week. They were just stuck in one spot. And that was my first, and I remember distinctly because after I got to doing a workout, I went to the bathroom and threw up. And that was like my welcome to college, mm-hmm. You know, welcome to the big leagues.
That's funny because other freshmen probably threw up for other reasons their freshman year. You threw up for an excessive workout.
Oh, yeah. I went in there and I never lifted weights and I touched it. I'm like, man, what's all this? Basketball shape, I was in. Weightlifting shape, I was not. Mm-hmm. And so Robert Hackett was our strength and conditioning coach then. So he got me where I needed to be. I needed to get stronger to play in the Big Ten because back then, the game was a lot more physical than it is now. And so I had to get ready for that. So he prepared me for that.
Yeah. So who was the class of the Big Ten that year that you were that freshman year? Who were the teams that you were looking up to try to beat?
Well, of course, we want to try to beat everybody. But,
well, yes.
You had Indiana and you had Michigan and Purdue at the top of the league back then. But you had Glenn Robinson on Purdue. C. Webb had left. Yeah, he had left the year before, but Michigan still had the 5-4, still had the rest of the crew up there, minus C. Webb. Indiana had Calvert Chaney and that crew. Mm-hmm. So those guys, we were chasing those guys. Those were the top cream of the crop, mm-hmm. so to speak, you know.
So we talked, I asked about the difference between, you know, high school classes and college class. Did you have a moment in college basketball where you realized it was different, even though you grew up, you know, playing such competitive basketball, that college basketball was different than what you'd played before?
Yeah. I mean, I noticed that when I first came in, that playing against somebody that maybe had been there same year as I was, or maybe another year, a sophomore year or whatever, that the physicality level, you know, the physical strength. Whereas complaining against somebody that was a senior, like I remember when we played Minnesota, it was real physical. They had the guy, I think it's Randy Carter and some of those guys. They had been there for 4 years, so they were big, strong bruisers, where I'm just coming in getting trying to get acclimated to this type of stuff or whatever. So when I played against them or whatnot, they had already been, you know, they were veterans of all that stuff. But they helped prepare me for my next year, my sophomore year. They taught me that I needed to work even harder. I thought I was working hard. They told me I needed to work even harder and get stronger to prepare myself for, you know, whatever I was going to do.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a memorable game or memorable games that freshman year?
I want to say, I mean, after I got our first game out of the way, I think I still hold the record. My first game, I had 27 points, my very first game. So that was my moment right there, getting that out of the way, I would say. Because, I mean, I know it was pressure, but I was used to it. But for me, I put pressure on myself to perform well and play well night in and night out and try to get us some wins. So I would say once I got that first game out of the way and then I had a good game, I'm like, okay, I can do this.
Okay. I should have looked it up, but how did that first year record-wise end up, and how far did you get?
Well, that's the best record we had. I mean, it had to be good enough for us to get to the tournament. We got to the tournament my freshman year, and we played Cincinnati in the first round. We won that game, and then we played Missouri, number one seed, in the second round, and we lost that game. And that was my freshman year.
Okay. So that had to have been a big deal on this campus that you were going to the tournament for the first time in 47 years.
Oh, it was something else. I remember that day because we were sitting there, we were all together, and we won the they announced us and put us at Wisconsin Badgers, or over here, we went to Ogden, Utah. That's where we were at for the tournament. Mm-hmm. And playing the Cincinnati Bearcats for the first game of the tournament, first round of the tournament game. And I just remember we got in cars, and we were just riding all over the place, honking horns and stuff like that or whatever. It was a big moment and great time that day, that evening.
What was I going to say? So who did that Missouri team have? I mean, if they were a top seed, they had...
What's his name? I'm saying Melvin Booker, point guard, a guard. Whose son plays for the Phoenix Suns right now? Javon Crudup, a guy from Chicago named Marlo Finner. So they had a good team. They were number one seed. So
okay,
yeah.
The other thing I was going to ask, you talked about the two big guys from Minnesota, but who were some of the other big guys that you had to play directly against that year?
They had Loris Van Den Berg. You had Deion Thomas, Shelly Clark from Illinois. Who else? I'm trying to think of who else stood out. Oh yeah, John Amici. Penn State, Allen Henderson.
And you were talking about the fact that, like, the games we watch this last weekend, not as physical as the games that were played in the early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way you can explain to somebody who doesn't know basketball as well as you do, how different it was playing then than it is playing now? Particularly for a you know, a center or a post guy like you.
Yeah, I understand that change happens, but to me, the changing of all these rules and the way they have them now, to me, it's not basketball like basketball should be. You see what I'm saying? So it's just like now. With the way the rules are, I don't feel you should compare the players of now, this generation, this era, with the players of the older generation, just because of the rule changes. Because that's the case, you take those guys, or Michael Jordan, or Dominique Wilkins, and these guys, and you put them in this era, the records that they would have set would never be broken. Now, I understand it's about freedom of movement and all this other stuff, but what I want to draw to attention is that out of all these rule changes that they make, And they always want to go to the video talking about, was it flagrant one or flagrant two, or was it contact with the head? But look back at the injuries from way back then and look at the injuries today. Less injuries. Mm-hmm. And I believe it's less injuries because your body adapts to what's going on. So, you know, back then, you can put your hand, you can hand check somebody, and you can make a person go left if that's their weak, you know, their weakness and whatnot. Nowadays, you can't do that. You put your hand on them, it's a foul. So imagine Michael Jordan playing in today's game with his first step. And if you, with his first step, and he get by you, and all that you can do is that's a foul. So he's making 15, 20 trips to the free throw line besides what he's going to get on his own. So this is like, to me, I understand, I played actually the way that we play right now over here. I told Coach Moore this. I said, the way we playing in Europe, they're going to wind up playing over here. Because we play 4 out, 1 in. That's what I played overseas, majority of the time. My 4-man, guy my height or taller, is outside shooting threes. Mehmet Okur, a couple of other guys or whatever. I played with Bellinelli. I played with Manu Ginobili over in Italy. So we played this system, you know, up and down, up and down. So just imagine the overseas game, smaller court. You got college court, pretty much college rules. You can play zone defense. You got a 24-second shot clock. And you got all these great athletes and players that can just condense and pack in on you and all this stuff or whatever. So it was definitely different. There was no illegal defense. And the physicality of the game was even more so than in college when you went overseas. So people think that it was easy. I won 17 championships. And then everybody was like, you know, why don't you want to play ball? I played 17 consecutive years at the highest level that they had to offer over there. I won 17 championships. And my seasons didn't end. I left in July. My season didn't end to June. I didn't have much of a break. So my body went through a lot in terms of the pounding that I took. So I think I'm in pretty good shape considering that all that I went through. The game is just like today, it's just totally different. But with that being said, when we play at Michigan State, Michigan State still keeps it physical. That's who Tom Izzo is as a coach. And, you know, I believe that you can't get ready for a game or a team like that or other teams that play physical. Other teams that play physical, you can't get ready for that if you're not already prepared for it in your own practice, in your own culture. Kind of, we call it, you know, it's just being soft. It is what it is. So you're either going to go out there and compete and play and be physical, or you're going to go out there and, like a Michigan State, they get pumped, kind of, sort of.
One check the time. Okay. I got a few more minutes if you have a few more minutes.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Good.
So season ends in Ogden, playing Missouri, and that's in March.
Yep.
What was your – obviously finished the spring semester, but what was your what was that next summer like? In between freshman sophomore year,
that was me preparing for the next year, and knowing that my role was going to increase because we were losing seniors. Tracy Webster, he was getting ready to go. The catalyst of our team, but I knew we were turning me and Mike, myself and Mike, and I knew that the freshman Darnell Hoskins, the point guard, he was going to have to step up and fill that role that Tracy had held down. So I was preparing myself. I just went in, I talked to Coach Stu Jackson, that left to go to the NBA. So he went to go be the coach for Vancouver and the general manager for Vancouver Grizzlies at the time. And so I had a coach's meeting with Stan, Coach Van Gundy, and I asked him what did he need me to do for us to be successful. And he told me he needed me to score more and rebound more and block shots and play defenses like I was, if I can, better. So I went off and I prepared myself for that. And I came back my sophomore year, and I think my freshman year I averaged, if I'm not mistaken, I averaged 13.9 points, so 14 points, and about 8-point-something rebounds, almost like 8.8, something like that, or whatever, and 2.5 blocks. So my sophomore year, the end of my sophomore year, I averaged 18 points, 12 rebounds and 2.5 blocks. So I increased my numbers like I had, but we didn't have the same team success. I had better individual success, mm-hmm. but we didn't have the same team success that we had the year before because we didn't make it to the tournament or did we make it to the NIT. So the season was just over with after that.
Okay. So that training that you did that summer, was that something that could be overseen by the coaching staff, or was there, because of NCAA rules, was it stuff that you sort of had to do on your own?
It was, you know what, it was on our own because we had goals that we had to meet when we came back.
Okay.
So you got a program, and this is a list of your goals, your bench press goal, your mile goal, whatever goal they seem fit for you to do, or what you needed to do, what you needed to improve on for you to come back to be a better player. Those are the goals that you had on your sheet, and you left, and you went and did this on your own. See, now it's different. The kids, it's mandatory for them to go to summer school and to have mandatory workouts with the coach, with the strength coach.
Okay.
Yeah.
But it wasn't back then when you were here?
No, only when we were in season, we had the rules were, you know, team rules. You work out 3 times a week with HAC. In between your classes, your schedule was set up like that. And we had individual instruction like 3 times a week where you wake up in the morning and you go get your skill work in before you go to class.
Okay. So you didn't take summer school classes that one summer you were here?
I went to summer school one time. And that was at the end of my year. That was at the end of my freshman year.
Okay. So that must have meant that you stayed here that summer.
No, because he let me do it from home. He told me it was papers that I had to do.
Okay.
I had to do multiple papers. He gave me the topics. I chose, it was 10 topics. I had to choose 5 topics and write 4-page essays on each one.
Okay.
And then he gave me a date to bring all of them to him.
So then you also did all your physical stuff at home too?
In Chicago, yep.
Okay. Was your mom still living in the projects then, or did she move since you were gone from King?
When I had left King, my mother, she did leave the projects, and she moved to the inner city, but was on the east side, which was still just as bad.
Okay. And so you came back second year, sophomore year, new coach, although you knew Stan Van because he was here, right?
Right.
And it sounds like there were a couple, at least one player, one major player who left.
Bill Tracy, yeah.
Who were there freshmen that came in that year that contributed?
My sophomore year?
Yeah, your sophomore
year. Yeah, Moselle Peterson, Sean Mason. We had Osita Washuku. He wasn't a freshman, but he was a junior, coming from junior college.
Okay.
And so, you know, the main people that played, Sean Doherty. So we had Sean Doherty was a freshman. We had Moselle Peterson from Kentucky was a freshman. Sean Mason, a freshman from Chicago, guard. So we had Mo was a guard, Sean was a guard, Sean Doherty was a power forward, stretch four, that's what he was. And Sean actually eventually started starting. He would eventually start starting or whatever. Moselle got in the game and played. Mace played sparingly. And that was it.
So was that team where you and Michael Finley, were you the two top players on that team?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You talked a little bit about it, but I wonder if you'd talk a bit more about why, you know, freshman year you made the tournament, won a tournament game. Sophomore year, didn't make the tournament, didn't make NIT.
A lot of it, I think, had to do with the loss of Tracy Webster. He was he was our leader in terms of that. Yeah, I mean, Mike, myself, might have been getting all the attention or whatever, but Tracy was, he was a leader. He's a veteran point guard, a leader that knew how to dictate the game, whereas Donnell didn't understand that this sophomore year. He didn't play much. So he tried to imitate what Tracy did, but he didn't do it as well as Tracy did.
Okay.
So that hurt us, the loss of Tracy Webster.
So in general, does your leader have to be your point guard? Does it help if it's your point guard?
It doesn't have to be the leader, but at the end of the day, regardless of what's said, your point guard is an extension of the coach on the floor. And all the time, the coach can't see certain things that's going on in the game that the player sees because he's out there. That's why it works. It works. I'm the coach. I'm watching you out there play. I see something that you don't see, but you're the player, and you see things that I don't see. Mm-hmm. So we have to talk, and we have to be, you know, be on the same wavelength, and that helps. That helps knowing, and then, you know, you got to have a smart point guard, because point guard, you need to know, point guard has the hardest job on the floor, because you need to know how every player out there operates. You need to know where they shoot the ball from, where to get them the ball left for them to be successful, and where not to give them the ball. You need to understand it's not them. They just want the ball. But you as a point guard need to understand this to put them in a position to succeed, for the team to succeed. And also to know when your team is tired. You got to judge all this. You got to look at your team, like, okay, they're tired. So you don't rest on defense, you rest on offense. So now I'm going to call a set. I'm going to hold the ball. I'm going to let them get a few minutes, a few seconds break, whatever, mm-hmm. catch their breath. Now we go into the action or whatever. I call my action now, whatnot, without even looking over at the coach. You know what I'm saying? Let them get a break. Let them get a breather. All right, now let's go quick hitter, whatever the case mm-hmm. may be. Smart point guard. It takes all that. Mm-hmm. I mean, you look at, I'll give you an example. You look at the guy, the Brunson from Villanova. Smart. Knowing where the advantages is are. And I learned that from playing with David Rivers. When I was in I was over in Turkey my fourth year. I was over in Turkey, and David Rivers, he was trying to recruit me to come over to Italy to play with him and Dominique Wilkins on the team to try to win a European championship. And that failed, and he asked me, where was I going? I said, I'm going back to Turkey. He said, do they need a point guard? And I'm like, yeah, we need a point guard. I convinced the owners of Tofas to get David, who's one of the top point guards in Europe, to get David so we can be successful. So they signed me and David on pretty much on a package deal or whatever. But David showed me what it was to be a professional, how to operate, because he was older, and you know how things should go. And like, we were being games, and it was championship games, and a coach would be calling the play, and Dave, I took the ball out of bounds and throw the ball. Dave said, where you want the ball at? What side? He said, let's go to whatever side you want to post up. I go over there, I post up, they clear everybody out, space everybody out, throw me the ball, two-man game. He knew, because he knew me from practice and playing in games. He know if I get doubled, that I'm a good pass, I'm going to hit the right man. He know if I'm not double, I'm going to the hole, I'm going to score, I'm going to get five. He know this. Mm-hmm. So we would just play a two-man game. If the game was close, well, no problem. He come down and dump the ball to me. They play me one-on-one, I go to work. If they come double, I find the open man. So we played that. In 2 years in Turkey, we won like 6-7 championships together. Huh. Just by doing that, the coach called a play. It wasn't a disrespect to coach, you know what I'm saying? The thing about it is this coach, he asked me, he's like, I called a play. He said, and I'm the one that's out there playing, and I'm the point guard. And I seen that they can't stop him. They double-team him. I trust his decision-making. He was just like, we won, right? Okay, him. That's right. It. He said, I've been here and done this. I've won European championships before. I played with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. I played with Magic Johnson. I know how this goes. You see them doing the same thing in the NBA. Game on the line, they go to their best player, or it's two-man game, you pick your poison, whichever one you want. Mm-hmm. They got to make a choice. You either going to stop him, because you just can't stop everybody. So I'm going to do my job. I trust him to do his job. That's it. Mm-hmm. And that was it. So like I said, I learned a lot from playing with David Rivers and about a point guard. So then after that started converting me to a point center, because my coach in Italy, that's what he called me. He said, you're my point center. He said, I trust your decision making better than I do Ginobili, because I know Ginobili gets a little bit wild at times. He's like, but you, I know you're going to take your time. You're either going to try to score. If you can't score, they come with two or three men on you, whatever. You normally make the right pass to the right player, even if it's not a pass to the person that directly can shoot, it's a pass to that person, to the next person, mm-hmm. that got an open shot or got cut into the lane or whatever the case may be, right. or whatever. So
you talked about coaches. Maybe one more thing, looks like it's already 2:30, is you talked about coaches. Maybe we could end today on the difference, what you saw as the difference between Stu Jackson and Stan Van Gundy, since they were both your coaches and both gained more fame after they left here, let's put it that way.
Stu was the game changer. And what I mean by that, from what I seen of him of the year that I had him and what I know from the previous years, and excuse my friend, he's getting an asshole. and he came in, and it was a one that he was. He came in and demanded change. So, he didn't want basketball and football on the same floor. He felt that basketball should have its own space. You know what I'm saying? He didn't want to have his own identity. And so he started asking for things accordingly. So when he came, we didn't have a culture or an identity at that time. He came, and football was forming this culture with Coach Alvarez. So Coach Alvarez came in without being an asshole and did it in a different way. He came in and said, this is how things are going to be done. That's it. Stu came in and said, okay, football's the top sport, you know, blah, 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 blah. So, you know what, but still, this is basketball, and this is what we're going to do. And once we made a tournament, he knew he had built that, you know what I'm saying, that, okay, look, now I can demand a lot more stuff. Because now they've seen that I can get the job done. So, but when he left, so then Stan was coming in behind Stu, which was a hard job in terms of, you know, you got to try to do what he did or better because of what he did, and he broke that drought. You know, broke that 47-year drought, and he built the culture. The culture was the same. We worked hard, we played hard, and stuff like that. Things didn't go the way that would have kept him here for another couple of years. And truth be told, if he would have been here, instead of, you know, them bringing Dick Bennett in, I probably would have stayed another year. That would have been my third coach in 3 years. So I was just like, you know what, that ain't looking good for me. So I'm like, you know what, I'm just going to go ahead and go. So, and then, you know, I built a relationship with Stan, and I still had a relationship to this day. So I think if he had more time, things would have definitely, because he's a great coach, things would have definitely kept on, you know, going on the upper path, which they did anyway. But, you know, even like when Dick came, we didn't make the tournament again in, what, 2000. We didn't make the tournament. Mm-hmm. So I was just like, you know, everybody, you go through those things or whatever. Then we hit our groove until this past year, what, 18, 19 years in a row. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it is what it is. But, you know, I mean, sometimes it's good for the kids to see what it's like, you know what I'm saying, the privilege that they have. Being here at the University of Wisconsin, being one of the country's top schools in the tournament every year, year after year after year, to see. Because, see, we went through that. I went through that. So I know it has made me hungrier and be like, okay, cool, you know what? I need to keep this thing moving forward. Mm-hmm. I need to work harder so I can pull somebody else up and pull weight if this person can't do this or that or whatever. So that's how it tends to work out.
Okay. Well, let's wrap it up today, and we'll come back and do this tomorrow. So this concludes the first interview with Rashard Griffith. Thank you, Rashard.
Thank you.
Okay, today is March 28th, 2018. This is the second interview with Rashard Griffith. Again, we're here at the Kohl Center. My name is Troy Reeves. So like we did last time, Rashard, if you could say your name and spell your last name.
Rashard Griffith, G-R-I-F-F-I-T-H.
Perfect. So we left off, you decided you were going to leave school to go pro. Mm-hmm. But there's a couple of questions I want to ask about, sort of back up and ask a couple of follow-up questions. Okay. So first off, you played your games in the field house.
Yes.
And I wonder if you could just try to explain, because, you know, after whatever it was, 97, 98, the game's been played here in the Kohl Center. So mm-hmm. I just wonder if you could try to explain to somebody who might be listening to this what it was like to play a game in the field house.
The field house is unique. As you know, it's a historical landmark. So, I mean, my time here, that's where we played all our games at. And the field house was, or is the barn, as they call it, is very unique. I guess when I signed here, that they sold out their season tickets in like 10 minutes or something like that. So, and that was the first time that happened in I don't know how many years. Mm-hmm. So that was exciting. It was always packed, and they were excited to come out and see, you know, what the badge. That's one thing about, I say, it's about Wisconsin sports and our fan base. We have a tremendously great fan base. We travel well. They support our teams, whether we're down, whether we're having a down year or we're having the best year. They support us wholeheartedly, and I want them to know that it's appreciated. And that was from back in the 90s until current day. Mm-hmm. You know, the field house would get to rocking, especially I remember games like when we played Purdue with Glenn Robinson or Michigan with the rest of the Fab Five. And, you know, the gym, you know, especially when teams were all, where everybody was against us. For whatever reason, we always looked at as an underdog. I'll never forget the NCAA tournament against Cincinnati. They were, you know, like, you know, Cincinnati was just that much better than us. We won. And it was just like, why nobody gives us credit, even during this season. At the end of the season, we finished well. Mm-hmm. But the field house, I wish that the guys that we have now, at least once a year, one game a year, we will be able to hold in the field house. Even if it's an exhibition game, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. This a game where we're able to hold in the field house, and so they can see the environment where why this was built in the atmosphere.
I need to carry in here.
Yeah, that's fine.
Would you mind opening the door for me, just so
sure.
I don't mess up the door at all?
Sure. Let me. Okay. So just finish up on the field house. People playing. One is today's athletes to play a game.
Yeah, I would like for it to be every year, at least one game a year. Is play it over there in the field house, either the red and white game, the scrimmage game that we have, mm-hmm. or better yet, I would like for it to be an official game. An official game like a preseason game, like we play Platteville, you know what I'm saying? Let's play them over there at the field house. Mm-hmm. Just so the guys can see how it was,
right.
You know, back then and then to now, to current events. I think because the Kohl Center is so spread out and so big sometimes that we have a tendency to sit on our hands, the fans. But over there, because the fans are like right up on you, it's a totally different atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
Totally different atmosphere. And I love that. Love the field house.
So I wanted to ask, if there were memorable classes or professors those first couple of years. Anyone that stand out?
I had Kurt Warner was definitely was one. He was my Afro-American history teacher mm-hmm. when I was here. And he was one. We just honored him. We just honored him too. This past year, he retired. He still sits on the chair of Dean of Letters and Science, but we just honored him from retiring. He was retired from being a professor.
Mm-hmm.
So we just honored him. My tutor, Nancy Gadius, mm-hmm. she was tremendous. I'm still in touch with her right now today.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm gonna say my current teachers right now that I have right now, because a lot of them were here. When I was there,
mm-hmm.
my lit tran teacher, Professor Patrick Rumble, Gina Longo, that was my social studies teacher. You know, even right now, Professor Kleibig, that's my Roman history teacher. You know, all these professors are now good, and now it's different for me because now I'm a grown man. I live life and. I'm not a teenage kid, mm-hmm. so now I know the value of relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And so the relationships that I'm making right now, including yourself, Troy, I mean, Professor Gadius, the field that I'm in, I know it's about building relationships. Sam Bite actually played, he was the punter on the 94 Rose Bowl team. So he was here when I was here, and I had him for two classes. I had him for CSCS 300 and CSCS 275. So I had him for those two classes already. And there's a lot of stuff between me and him that are shared or whatever. We were here when that turnaround was happening for Wisconsin sports, mm-hmm. Two major sports,
mm-hmm.
football and basketball. So, my professors play a large role in who I am and still playing a large role in who I am today.
Yeah. So I was going to ask this later, but since you brought up current, I wonder if there's a way you could explain, you know, Rashard as a student, an 18, 19-year-old student, and Rashard today going to class?
Rashard as an 18, 19-year-old student, I was concerned about playing basketball and just getting my good enough grades to stay eligible to play. Because I knew in my mind, I had my mind set on going to be a professional athlete. So I was just like, okay, look. It wasn't that I was doing a bare minimum. I was just like, but that wasn't really what was on my mind. Mm-hmm. It was like, go to class. Make sure you're there. Make sure you're present. Get good enough grades to stay eligible so you can play, so you can be out there on the floor. And then everything else take care of itself. Now that I've lived life and I'm through playing basketball, I'm sharing my experiences in life with my classmates that I'm in front of daily, my teachers. Because I may be older than some. I don't even know how. For instance, I don't even know how Jennifer is, but I might be older than her. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, I'm sharing this stuff with people who may not know, and then the experiences that I had in playing basketball, now I'm sharing them with the kids that we have here today and the kids that are coming in, so I can share my life experiences with them, what it takes to how to help them understand that each level you go to, from high school, from grammar school to high school, from high school to college if you're blessed enough to go and be a professional athlete, to teach them that you have to keep reinventing yourself year by year. You have to come back with something new. Mm-hmm. Add something to your game to make your team better, first of all. I mean, you make yourself better. By you making yourself better, you make your team better. And how building relationships now is what's going to carry you through the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. For instance, me, the relationship that I built with Coach Alvarez, with Coach Moore, et cetera, is what helped me to be back here right now in school, finish getting my degree, and working for the athletic department with a bigger role to come. Mm-hmm. So, and that was a relationship that I built that I didn't know of when I was 17 years old. Right. So I didn't have anybody to teach me that. That was, like I told you before, a trial by fire. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm telling these kids, these young men and women right now, is that these things that are going on in your life right now are significant, whether you know it or not. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, you take a Zach Showalter, graduated, tried his hand at playing professional basketball overseas, didn't work out for him. He's working at a bank right now, and he's going to build his way up, because Shoy's a hard worker. He's going to build his way up to one day I can see him being the president or the CEO of something real soon. Mm-hmm. You take Matt Ferris and Mason and all these guys that has graduated right now, and TJ, these guys, they're still on campus. They're finishing out, they're going to graduate, and they have jobs waiting for them right now. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's not too many places that have those things, and part of that too is realizing who and what you are, in terms of, you know, if you have an opportunity to play professional sports after you finish playing, you know, if that reality is that you're not going to be playing and you're going to be either working on your own business, or you're going to be working in a 9-to-5. Either way it go, being real with yourself and true to yourself is part of that, so that way you can map out your goals that you have, your five-year goal, your 10-year goals, etc. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm trying to teach these young men and women, these things to move them forward, that being real with yourself, it starts with you. Mm-hmm.
And so when you were here as a freshman and sophomore, there just wasn't that infrastructure to help the young athletes.
It was building. Stu came in and started it. Coach Alvarez had it more farther along with football, because he came in to change the culture. Two-a-day practices, this and that. A lot of people quit. Stu came in right behind Coach Alvarez, did the same thing for basketball. This is our standard. We're not going to stand for anything less than this. And sometimes that's what it takes. And then that's what got the ball rolling. I mean, the people before, they did jobs and put bricks too. But these are the people that really came and they put the foundation, like, this is it. This is what needs to be done for us to get here and to stay here. Mm-hmm. And that's what Stu did, and that's what Coach Alvarez did as far as with football and with basketball. I mean, as you see what Coach Alvarez done since he's been an athletic director, what he's done for the university. Mm-hmm. I mean, Stu Jackson, it propelled him to, he was second behind David Stern in the NBA. You know, now he's second in charge of the Big East Conference of basketball. So it's just like all these things that propelled them throughout their career for the next stages of their lives.
Mm-hmm. So you talked about building relationships when you're here now. Mm-hmm. But I wonder, outside of, you said you stayed at the region, lived at the region.
Yeah.
So outside of the basketball players that you know, your brothers as you called them, were there other people when you were here the first time as a freshman and sophomore, particularly students who you got to know and build relationships with?
Students, besides my teammates, there were a few. It wasn't even actually students. Bill Heaps, he was working for the university back then. He had just graduated not too long ago. He's not that much older than me. But he was important. I still talk to him to this day. He still works with youth. And actually what Heaps did, he did something pretty awesome for me. All since before I got to campus, he took all of the articles that were ever printed about me or about me, good, bad, or whatever, and he made me a scrapbook of them. So I have two large, fully stocked scrapbooks. If you would like, I gave them to my son so he can so see them, so he can hold on to them, so he can look through it. And if you would like, I can have him bring them up at one day so you can see them. I mean, because it's, everything is detailed. And he even left me a letter in the scrapbook that I look back at too right now. And it's to this day, he said the same thing that I say right now today, is that it's not your basketball who makes you who you are. You are who you are because the way your parents raised you and the way God created you. Mm-hmm. And that's what it is. Basketball got me to a certain... Basketball was the stage. That was my platform to let the world know what I can do. But it also allowed me the opportunity to let them know who I am, to find out who I am. And it's allowing me right now today to get out my passion and my want to help young men and women not go astray, and let them know that even if you're not be a professional, the kids that I train. So my thing is this: what do you want to be? I said, what's your B plan? So I mean, when I was coming up, nobody asked me what my B plan was. My A, B, C, D was all NBA, professional. That was it. Mm-hmm. Now, what's my B plan? My B plan came farther along. So I want to put these in the young men's and women's minds. What's your B plan? So if this doesn't work, then what's your backup? So so you can go to school, get a full ride, knowing, let's say women, for instance. The NBA, WNBA is not for every woman like it is for men's basketball. So I had one young lady, she told me, she was just like, I want to go to Stanford University because they had the best neurosurgeon program in the world, in the United States, and I want to be a brain surgeon. She knew exactly what she wanted to do. So I said, if you don't make it to the WNBA, what's your next move? She reared it off just like that. She knew exactly what she wanted to do. And that's what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. What's your B plan? You know, she's like, I know my mother and father can't afford to send me there, so you either get to get an academic scholarship or be good enough to get a scholarship offer from the women's basketball team so I can go there for 4 or however long I need to go to be you know, to get my degree and what I wanted to get in. So that's what basketball has done for me. It gave me the stage, it put me on the stage to perform and show them who I am as a basketball player. Then later on, it allowed me to, okay, this is who I am as a person. So do you accept me as you did as a basketball player, as a person?
Okay. So when we finished up last time, your sophomore season had ended and you decided that you're going to go pro. I don't know exactly what the process is, but I know there's a process now to announce that you're going to go pro. What was it like when you were deciding that?
It's the same process. So once I decided I knew I was going to go pro, I had my meeting with my coach, which was then Stan had already told me what was going on, that he was gone. So I had a meeting with the new coach coming in, which was Dick Bennett. We had a couple meetings. Both decided that it wasn't going to be, you know, conducive for me to be here because of the style of play he played wasn't going to translate to the NBA because of the way he wanted to walk it up, half-court defense, and stuff like that or whatever. You know, the NBA is an up-and-down game. So decided that. So I'm like, okay, cool. That made my decision easy. So once that happened, I talked to my mother and my father and told them what I wanted to do. They backed me 100%, said it's your career. If you feel that you're ready, then, you know, we're behind you. So then I told, at that point, it was the same thing it is today. If I wouldn't have hired me an agent, I could have went through the process and still came back to school. But I hired an agent because I knew I wasn't going to come back to school at that point in time. So it's the same process. And then from there, once I hired me an agent, I started to work out 5 times a day to get ready for the combine and the draft and stuff so I can be in the best shape possible when that time came. So I lifted weights when I was in the gym with Tim Grover, which was the guy who trained Michael Jordan in Chicago. I took aerobics, I took ballet, I took karate, and of course, just playing basketball.
Right.
So that was my process up until the draft and even after the draft.
So were there people besides your agent who were counseling you on how best to prepare for the NBA?
Yeah, Harvey Ketchens, former NBA player, played for the Bulls, took me through drills and stuff like that to get me ready to be a better rebounder. You know, Boo Williams, who was who was actually with the Harlem Grove Charters back then. He helped me work on my ball handling, my ability to catch the ball. Then my friends, cousin Leonard Knight, my Varell family, Reggie Martin, my brother DeLondre Griffith, they all were there with me in the gym, helping me to Howard Moore, helping me to form who I was really, where I really was. Because one thing that I told them, from me seeing the blessing that came from me being exposed to the stuff that I was exposed to at an early age with basketball, it taught me how to the people around me, excuse my friends, don't blow smoke up my ass. Mm-hmm. Tell me the truth. I'd rather for you to tell me what it is right now than sitting up there, you tell me something just so I would, you know, feel a certain way about it. No, tell me the truth. I'm a big boy. Let me deal with it and get it out the way. So then that way we ain't got to keep on revisiting the same thing over and over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. Tell me one time, get it out the way, we done with it. And so that's one thing that I credit all my people for, and my people around me, for my mother, my father, my sister, my brother, my the guys, people I just mentioned, even right now. That's why me and Howard's relationship the way it is right now. I mean, I don't consider myself to have friends because my circle is not real big. So mm-hmm. everybody that is with me and around me, that is my family. Mm-hmm. That is my family. And I believe that besides if you blood or you not blood, I consider Howard's mother and father like my mother and father. Mm-hmm. They're an extension. Coach Alvarez is like a father to me. I mean, you know, everybody that's around me, if you're with me in my circle and you see me sit up here for the last couple of days and my phone doesn't ring that much unless it's somebody. When my phone rings, there's somebody important. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't just give my number out to everybody, and if I don't know the number, I don't answer it. And it's not that I'm, people are like, well, that's conceited. No, it's not. I said, if I don't know the number and answer it, I say, I don't like dealing with negativity. Mm-hmm. If you're a negative person, you can keep that over there mm-hmm. to yourself. Mm-hmm. Now, when you get yourself together and you calm down, get out mm-hmm. your feelings, then you can come talk to me. Because mm-hmm. I don't want to deal, I just refuse. I've seen it, I've been through it, and I know it's just not who I am as a person. So I don't need to deal with that. If I can help you, I'm a person that'll give you a shirt off my back if it's going to help you. Now, once I do that, if you sit there and you misuse that, that's on you. But it won't be a second time after that. Mm-hmm. That's just me. Mm-hmm.
So we could do a whole oral history on your time in professional basketball. Because it's a long stretch. There's a couple of questions I want to ask, though, to make sure we get them on the record, and that's, when did you first realize that playing basketball in Europe could be an option, and then it was an option?
Actually, Troy, that came about by after I got drafted. I was in Mike Dunleavy was the head coach of the Bucks when I got drafted. So after I got drafted, went in the office and sat down and met with him. Since I got drafted in the second round, it's not guaranteed money. So I was going to be making about close to $200,000. That's before taxes. Now, it doesn't matter. Either way it went, it was going to be more money than I ever made in my life, so it didn't matter. So, but what Mike Dunleavy proposed to me and my agent was that I go overseas for a year or two, and this is when I started learning about the politics of the game. They had these guys, Armand Gilliam, Irvin Johnson, who played for the Bucks, who had these big contracts. So they got these big contracts. They got to justify this by them playing and earning their dollar money. So by me being 19, they drafted right a year after they drafted me, and then the nucleus was going to be Vin, myself, Glenn Robinson, Ray Allen. Me and Glenn had a great relationship. People don't know. Me and Glenn Robinson just lit together. Back when I was my senior year in high school and my freshman year in college, which was just the sophomore year in college, we lived together during the summers. He would come to Chicago. We played on the same pro-am team. My pro-am team consisted of Glenn Robinson, Michael Finley, Jawan Howard, Donnie Boy, Sherelle Ford, myself. We had the top, Chris Webber, he would come to town. We had the top college guys and future high school guys playing in pro-am. We playing against the Michael Jordans and, you know, all these guys, Tim Hardaway's, during the summers in Chicago. So Glenn stayed with me during that time. Well, we stayed together. My mother had got this She had moved out. We had moved out of the projects. I was getting ready to go to college, so she had moved out of the projects, and she moved, I told you, 81st and Kingston. So what happened was the building was owned. A building was owned by somebody who Glenn knew, and Glenn had told me about it before in passing or whatever. And my mother was like, yeah, we can take the top floor. It's no problem. We got 3 bedrooms, so we good. Cool. So we moved over there. Glenn stayed in the basement. The owner stayed in the middle floor. We stayed on the top floor. It was cool. And it was only temporary because I knew in my head once again that I was going to be going professional. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so put these contracts out on the table when I was in the office with Coach Dunnelly and my former agent. And so I had Turkey, Italy, Greece, Spain, all these contracts in front of me, including the one for the Bucks. So me, being young, I'm looking at which one got the most money. So the one in Turkey was the one that was offering the most money, and I think it was like $575,000 for the entire year. Was passing the physical. So I was like, okay. So I'm like, it didn't matter where I went because either way it was going to be a new adventure for me. So I sat there and I chose the one for Turkey. So I was 19 years old, getting ready to leave from
Happy Spring Breakfast.
Sonny Yuki. Getting ready to leave from Chicago to go to Turkey. And I was like, man, I'm like, I've read about this stuff in history books when I was in school, but I never figured that I would be getting ready to go over here, more or less live over here. And it was a unique experience. So, a funny story. So, when I finally decided what I was going to do, I signed a contract to go to Turkey. We faxed it over. This is before, you know, of course, email and all this stuff was big. So, faxed the contract over, signed it. They sent me never had a passport. So they sent me my plane ticket. They walked me through the steps of what to do to get my passport. So I told my father, my uncle, my mother, and my agent. I said, I don't know if you're familiar with the movie Midnight Express. Mm-hmm. Imagine a 19-year-old kid seeing this and then your parents messing with you, or my father, my uncle primarily, messing with me, talking about, you know, if you go over there and you steal something, they cut your hands off. They throw you in the jail with the and then they showed me this movie. And I'm like, oh. Y'all going too? And they were like, no, we not. I'm like, yeah, y'all going too. So what happened was I took all of them with me. So I told the team, I'm like, look, my parents and everybody got to come with me. If they're not coming, I'm not coming. So I told my agent that. So my agent, I guess he reiterated the message to them. And they were like, okay, no problem. So we all went on over to Turkey. It was a 24-hour trip. Got there, looking at the country and stuff like that or whatever, looking around, hearing people speak a different language. Went and did took my physical or whatever. Was nervous about that because I'm like, I'm in a foreign country. Did they do the same things the same way? And to show you how I was almost ignorant to the fact of stuff, Troy, I was so commercialized with our food had to be processed before we ate it. So this was during the Ramadan in Turkey. So I look out my window of my apartment. I see people out there in the field. I hear the music going on, cutting cows and goats and stuff, throats and stuff like that. I'm like, Pop, I'm not going outside today. I said, there's a lot going on. Now, they explained it to him, but they didn't explain it to me. So we had a feast at my gym, the team's gym. So I went and I said, man, I said, there's a lot of food. They were like, yeah, that's all the animals that they were killing outside and stuff like that today or whatever. I said, well, I can't eat that. He's like, why not? I said, because it ain't been processed. Everybody started laughing. So I'm like, what's so funny? They were like, Rashad, this is the way you need to eat it. It's natural. It's good. But I said, no, I'm going to stick with the processed stuff, you know, until I wised up and found out, you know what I'm saying, mm-hmm. about, you know, that it was better for me, actually better for me. And the taste and everything, I can tell the difference from the taste and everything. When I'm like, man, why they do that to us in the United States or whatever? So it was one of those things with a learning experience. But my time playing over there, God has a purpose for us and a path that I could have chose different paths, and they all would have led different ways. But the path that I took going to Turkey has led me to, once again, goes back to the relationships. I've been dealing with kids from Turkey for the past going on 6 years, with their parents remembering me, who I was and what I did when I played over there. I wanted their kids to have that grit, that toughness, that winning attitude, and I won 17 championships over there. So they know me, they know what I'm capable of, and they know the person that I am. So that was my adventure, and every place that I went to, only country I didn't win a championship in was Spain. That's the only, every other place that I played in, I won a championship. So, been blessed to play with some great players. I was blessed to play over there, you know, and have a great career. So, my time overseas, but I believe it was meant for me to go over there and do what I did. Once again, the relationships that I built and seeing a different part of the world, and now it takes me back now to present day in the classrooms and stuff that I'm in. I tell some of my classmates that it's always the negative stuff that you put on the news. I was over in Israel when Saddam Hussein was getting ready to send the sarin gas over there, and the army come knocking on my door 4 o'clock in the morning, giving us gas masks with the syringes and stuff like that, showing us a video of what to do if this happens, and before missiles get ready to strike, they're gonna come and get us and put us on the plane, take us to Germany, and blah 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 blah. And I'm like, no, I'm 21 years old. I'm like, man, hold on, I ain't signed up for no war. What is going on? My father, calm, cool, and collected. That's where I think I got it from. He was like, no worry, we'll be all right. He's like, you know, that's why they came over to let us know or whatnot. They knew by stamping our passports and stuff. That's why the system is the way it is. If I don't get my passport to them, you know, people, passport control when I'm coming through, they don't know I'm in Israel. So, you know, so, but by me doing that, they knew I was in Israel, they knew where I stayed at, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So they knew to look for me, to let them, you know, to let me know, we know you here, and this is what, these are what's the steps to follow if blah, 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 blah happens. And I was over in Turkey for the earthquakes. I've been around the world. I mean, and I seen the historic sites, the Vatican, been there. I've been to the Roman Colosseums. I've been there. I lived over in Italy for 3 years. Mm-hmm. So I've seen all this stuff, from the food, the agriculture, the culture in general. And every country, when I was over there, they welcomed me with open arms. So I never had a problem when I was over there playing ball and living over there. And actually, I prefer to live over there. Besides here, I prefer to live over there. Mm-hmm. The lifestyle suits me. It's laid back. It's easy, you know what I'm saying? I mean, it's just, have you ever been overseas, Troy? I mean, for a long period of time, and met every country that I played in, a family that just like took us in. Hmm. Yep, a family that like took us in, and it was just like, it was amazing. Mm-hmm. So my time playing overseas was great.
So, you know, eventually, as you got overseas, stayed overseas, there's technology, there were ways to sort of keep in touch. Mm-hmm. But early on, I'm guessing there wasn't as many ways to sort of keep in touch. So how did you try to keep in touch or with, you know, your friends and family back home?
The early part of when I was over there, it was just a telephone. It wasn't even a cell phone. It was a regular house phone, and my phone bill was $2,500 a month.
Jeez.
Yeah, when I first got overseas. Then my father, once again, a blessing. My father stayed with me the first 7 years of my professional career. He was like, since then, you know, even though I stayed with him, me and my brother during the summers and stuff, that kind of stopped when I got older, because I was basketball to consume my life. So, and then my brother was off doing what he was going to do, so we didn't stay as much. So when he retired from work my freshman year of high school, he had got his years done. So he had been working since he was 13. So all his years were put in with the company, so he was able to retire. So what wound up happening was he asked me when I came over there. He was like, hey, if you don't mind, I want to stay over here with you for a longer period of time. I was like, no problem with that, Pops. That's cool with me. So my father wound up staying over there. He's like, I can just stay over here with you and just go with you and follow you around. I can take care of the simple stuff, and you can just concentrate on just going to play basketball and doing what you do. I can do the grocery shopping. I can do the banking stuff. Whatever you need for me to do, I can take care of that. I'm like, you know what, Pops? Ain't no problem. You can do that. Not a problem, Pops. So my mother, my uncle, my agent, they went back home. My father stayed over there with me. And he was just telling me and teaching me life lessons. I mean, from the time the first contract, he told me my life was about to change, kind of like Coach Perry said. Everybody's going to see you differently now because you're making this money. And that came to be true. I started looking at how people looked at me as a dollar sign instead of as Rashard. Mm-hmm. And other stuff that he showed me, and he brought me through, and he walked me through the aspects of life of being a person, especially when I became a millionaire, life of being a person that has a large sum of money in your bank account, and that's how people count your money for you. And he started just showing me life. And telephone, once he told me telephone, I'll tell you that to tell you about a telephone. I was just like, I asked him, I know where I got it from. I said, Pops, why don't you don't talk to nobody? I think he talked to his brother maybe twice a year. I'm like, Pops, you don't call and check on grandma? You don't call and check on aunt? You know, what's going on? He said, no, man, I'm not a big phone person or a big communicating person like that. So for me, when I got over and I found out that, he said, why are you spending all this money on this phone bill? He said, oh, I understand that. He said, you spending $2,500 because he paid the bills. So you know, he's spending $2,500 a month on the phone. Talking about, what are you talking about? He said, okay, if you talk to your agent, okay, I understand that. He said, but you're talking to girls. What you talking to girls? What are you talking for $2,500? What are you talking about? Is something important you getting married that I don't know about? No. Like, what are you talking about? Couldn't come up with no answer, just talking. He said, you bring Reggie over here, you brought Lenny over here, you brought your boys over here. So they come over here and stay months at a time. So what are you talking about? They need to be working too. So he's like, $2,500, he said, I think you need to cut that down a little bit. So I cut back and I just eventually just stopped altogether. I made the phone calls that I needed to make or whatever. He said, how about you do a test? See who called you. Let's do that. Did that test. My mother, that's probably about this about it, and my agent, that was it. So he's like, he said, I'll make a deal with you. He said, if they don't call you, he said, I'll be real. If they call, I'll take the number down or whatever, and I give it to you, let you know who called. But those who don't call you I give them 2 months. Let's see who called you the most in 2 months, and then those people you can talk to. I said, okay, cool. So I just waited. 2 months passed by or whatever, and he put the thing on the paper, piece of paper on the refrigerator. He was like, that's who called you in 2 months. I looked at it, and he had it broke up. Called to see about who you are, called just because they want some money. Mm-hmm. And he put an X to the ones who wanted some money. And he was just like, that's it. And that was my mother and my agent, and that was it. He was like, so I would advise you not to talk to them like that. I'm spending $2,500. They calling you want some money, but you're spending a large amount of money to talk to them about you sending them a large amount of money. He's like, that don't add up to me. And he's like, it's your money, you can do what you want to. He's just like, but I'm just giving you my advice and from what I see, from the outside looking in. So that happened. And then even after Facebook came out and what's the other one called, Troy? What you on?
The one that was like Facebook?
Yeah, no, it wasn't even like Facebook. I think it was before Facebook. The one when you on the computer, Skype. Skype came out. So, I mean, I still got the accounts. Never used them. So what I did is to manage my money after my father left and had to stay in the States or whatever for his health reasons or whatever. He got over there, started eating all his food and drinking his wine and stuff, and he caused himself health problems or whatever. So he had to stay in the States and get on top of that. So I was by myself. So what happened was we sat there and I would just get the little cards. So I would go and spend $100 a month on phone cards. And that way I knew how much I was spending a month on my phone bill. Mm-hmm. I cut that down. Okay. And that's how I did it.
So did there come a time where you realized that playing in Europe was going to be your career and it wasn't going to be coming back and playing in the NBA?
Yeah. You know what? That was after my third year, which I was over in Israel, which was 97. I knew that the way they treated me, especially when I was over in Turkey. So I played 2 years in Turkey. Then my third year in Israel, I was a millionaire. And then after that, I had a 3-year contract to play for playing over Maccabi Tel Aviv in Israel. And then I wasn't happy. Turkey knew I wasn't happy. They found out, I guess my agent told them. And they offered they brought me out of my contract in Israel and brought me back to Turkey. And I stayed over there another additional 2 to 3 years playing with David Rivers. And that right there, I was like, you know what? But see, the thing about it is, mostly every summer, I went back to the Bucks, and I went to the camp, to the summer camp, before they get ready to go to play the summer leagues and stuff in Utah and wherever like that. And I would go and play, and you know, do it because they still have my rights. So to go to show you, Troy, it was my choice. I had a contract on my front porch for 15 straight years from the Milwaukee Bucks, leaned up against my door, but July 1st. If they would have missed one day of not having that contract, or if it came July 2nd, I was a free agent. So I had a contract, and I think the money never exceeded like $500,000. So every summer, July 1st, actually it was like the 28th, they made sure it ain't cut it close or whatnot. I had a contract leaning up against my front door from FedEx, from the Milwaukee Bucks, opened it up, and that was just storming the file cabinet. I look at it, and as the money for the second rounders went up, or you can get more or whatever, it was always just a money thing, the reason I didn't go and stay in the NBA. I said, look, especially when I had kids and stuff like that, and you know, I was with my ex and stuff like that, or whatever, I'm like, now I got a family. So I'm not 19, 20 years old no more, I'm by myself. Now I have wife, kids, et cetera, et cetera. So now I have responsibilities I got to take care of. So if you give me $1 million, that's about $600,000 over here. I get $1 million from over there, it's pretty much what it is, because I pay taxes on my money over there, and they can't tax you twice. And when I bring the money back over here, the taxes are a little to none. So I'm getting my money, you know what I'm saying? So I'm like, if you can give me something, and I'm like, let me prove myself. Put in the contract that I can play 10 to 15 minutes a game, whatever, you know what I'm saying? They wasn't willing to do these things. So I'm gonna stay where I'm at, I'm good. I'm straight, I was happy with it. And to this day, I'm content with my decision.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let me check the time. Mm-hmm. Okay, we got a few more minutes this time.
Yep.
So when you played in Turkey, was most of your time in Turkey, or did it end up that you spent a lot of time other places?
Let's see. Turkey, I played a total of 4 years. 4 years in Turkey. I played Italy for 3 years. I played Kingdom of Bologna for two, and I played in Rome while I lived in Rome for one. I was in Spain. I played for Tenerife for 1 year, Calpe for 1 year. What else did I play in Spain? Altar Victoria. So that was 3 years in Spain. And Israel, I was there for a year. Romania, I was there for about 4 years in Romania. So Turkey and Romania was kind of equal as far as the years and stuff like that. So, you know, it was split up.
We talked about this a little bit last time. I don't know if we actually got it on the court, and though the difference you saw between European basketball, particularly once you really started, you knew that was where you were going to be playing, mm-hmm. and then college or /NBA at that time.
Yeah. Well, like I was telling you before, the rules over there back then to this day, see, FIBA and the NBA, FIBA doesn't want to be like the NBA. So, you know, you think about the rules. So they're like, okay, cool. We're not going to play 48 minutes. We're going to play 40 minutes. There's college rules, but pretty much international rules. When they go to the Olympics, it's the same thing. So we're going to play 40 minutes versus 48. We're going to have a 24-second shot clock, like the NBA, but you can play. There's no illegal defense. You can play zone defense. You can play whatever kind of defense you want. The court is college rules, not NBA. And I think college is 80-something feet, and NBA is 94 feet. So the court is just college rules. You can knock the ball off the rim. If somebody shoot a shot and it's bouncing on the rim, I can go up and knock it off. If my teammate shooting is bouncing on the rim, I can go up and while it's on the rim and put it in. Over here, you can't do that. It's offensive goaltending. It's more physical over there than it is here. Even right now, to this day, if you go over there, I've seen people get sent home because they couldn't adjust. And I almost got sent home my first year over there, because you're trained a certain way coming up. So all the years that I had to untrain myself because how the rules are. So for instance, how here we get the ball, you can pass me the ball, Troy, and I want to go right or whatever, I can just catch it and go. Over there, you can't do that. If I want to catch it and go, I have to catch the ball. My left leg has to cross over my right foot, and I have to put the ball on the floor before I move. Yeah, that's the those are the differences. So I'm catching the ball and I'm going and I'm doing what I've been trained to do or what I've been taught to do. 10 travel calls in one game. Wondering why I'm faking the guy and they coming down on my back and landing on me or whatever and able to push me and knock me off my spot and stuff like that. And the ref not calling the foul. So what I did, that was the first half of my season. I came back home. We had a break. I came back home. We had a two-week break. I came back home. Recharged. My agent was upset. They're talking about they want to cut you. I said, cut me. And I'm like, I wasn't doing bad. They were like, you know, talking about the turnovers and stuff. So when I got back, I made a relationship with the assistant coach. I told him to show me we spent extra time after practice and stuff to show me what can I do to not get these travel calls and all this stuff or whatever, blah, 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 blah. We worked on it. Second half of the season over there, my first year, I averaged 24 points, 15 rebounds, and 5 blocks, and I was the youngest person at 19 years old to ever win the MVP in that league. That catapulted me to be who I was over there. So I started making my name. Then I learned from like Dallas Comegys and older guys, Charles Shackelford or whatnot. They was like, when you play in these teams, the European competitions or the top teams in your league, you make sure you show up and show out. That's how they said it to me, because those teams are looking at you, and then that's how they want you to bring me from TOFAS, because TOFAS always finished between 4th and 8th. We finished 4th my first 2 years over there, made it to the playoffs, made it to quarterfinals and stuff like that or whatever. And what wound up happening was the little cup we were in, I played against an Israeli team. That's how I got on Maccabi Tel Aviv's radar. And that's when they offered me, you know, to be $1 million or whatever at 21 years old or whatever. And the TOFAS was like, bam, you know, we want to do this. So I took pride in, once again, taking a team that was in the middle of the pack always for their history, from the middle of the pack to the top of the league. So when me and David Rivers, we got back over there on my second go-round for TOFAS, we won every championship. We won 8 championships in 2 years. So you got, we have 2 playoff championships, President Cup. That's at the beginning of the season, like a preseason tournament they have. We won 2 of those. 2 Turkish Cups, two playoff championships, and finished in first place. Those considered to be championships. And so did that, took them to that. And like I said, I still have a relationship with the organization right now, mm-hmm. from doing those things. Because I took pleasure in doing that. A team that hadn't done anything from always finishing the middle of the pack to getting them outside their comfort zone. They wasn't used to spending money to get top-line players. See, they got me when I first came out. Then once my reputation grew, my agent was like, look, this team is offering him this. He was able to come to them with these contracts to show that the man is making over $1 million+. You got to meet him or he's going to go somewhere else. So they had to understand that. He had to go back to the drawing board. And like, if you want this David Rivers, he's won a European championship. The man is a high commodity. He's one of the top point guards in Europe. You got to pay for this. You pay for this, this is what you can get. Mm-hmm. And they got what they paid for. And so, like I said, I'm forever grateful for my experience and my time playing overseas and playing in Turkey, and them giving me my shot, my beginning, and never giving up on me, having faith in me and trusting a 19-year-old kid at the time. Mm-hmm.
So when did you know that your professional career there was over, or when did you decide it was time to quit?
Talking about this overall?
Yeah.
It was my last year. I was in Romania, and I tore my Achilles. So that's when I knew it was time for me to be like, okay. But you know what? Even after that, I had already signed a contract to come back the following year. But after that, my body was physically, mentally tired from. What up, man? I was physically, mentally tired. Like I told you, Troy, it was 17 years of straight, really no rest, no vacation. Only vacation that I had It was basketball related. Another only one I took a trip to. Imagine this. I'm in Rome. I'm in Venice. I'm wherever. And I can't really get out and go and see the sights. Life answers. I brought you and your family over. I brought several of my friends over. Jonathan Love and his wife or whatever. They came over and stayed for a couple of months with me and stuff like that or whatever. They able to go sightseeing, do whatever they want or whatever. I got a schedule I got to keep. Just like in college. It's almost, when I tell you it's almost just like college, Troy, you save money over there because we go on a road trip. The team takes care of everything. We eat together, three meals a day, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, just like you do here when you're on the road. We're on the road, we went to Northwestern. Breakfast together as a team, lunch together as a team, dinner together as a team. You got time, you got to be in your room. It's the same exact schedule. So I was accustomed to that. I ain't got to come up with my money for nothing or whatever. I'm used to the guy with the guys in the NBA go through. They give you a per diem, and if you spend that, then the rest of the money come out of your pocket. Team pay for the hotels, but everything else is on you. Mm-hmm. Team take care of everything or whatever. If I brought my my friends over or whatever, team, you know, they give me tickets and stuff. Team took care of that. I ain't have to pay for no airline tickets, you know what I'm saying? So I can have people come and go. But it was just I never had a vacation, Troy. Mm-hmm. I mean, even right now to this day, it was just like, it's always just been straight through. Like, during the summer, I got summer school. You know what I'm saying? So I'm not going nowhere. I'm trying to focus on getting this done, getting my degree and graduating. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm, but and even if, like I said, if I went somewhere or did something, it was always basketball. I had a game, or I got to go do this, or I got to go do that. So I'm like, you know what, let me concentrate to make sure this goes right. And I always made sure everybody else was taken care of and straight. And didn't worry about myself. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the things that my father had brought to my attention or whatever. He's like, you make sure everybody else is good, but what about you? When are you going? So when I knew it was done, tore my Achilles, I came back, I had my surgery. To show you kind of trust, I didn't trust the doctors overseas. When I got through and I got back to the States, I came up here and Henry and Doc Warren examined me and said, yep, you tore your Achilles. Okay, got to have surgery. Okay, cool. I didn't question what they said. But the other doctor said, I questioned what they said. Mm-hmm. Or whatever. I'll take care of it when I get home.
Right.
And that's what I did. So then I did that. I rehabbed. I did everything I needed to do. And I was working out. And I was just like, I was going through all the workouts, Troy, and I was just like, I'm tired. I said, I'm actually physically tired and mentally tired from all this. And I was just like, I went out on top. We won the championship. I got hurt in the championship game. We were up 3-0. It was in the fourth quarter, like 6 minutes to go. I was in there, and I went up for a shot that I've done a million times before, and I just felt like this on the back of my leg. It didn't hurt. No pain. No pain at all. But I knew I couldn't explode. That's when I knew something. I thought I sprung my ankle. And it wasn't the back of my leg. It was my ankle. I thought I twisted my ankle. I was like, what is that? What's wrong? I took my Achilles. So, guess what? Surgery, off for 9 months, sitting up there. I got back in shape. Just didn't have it in me no more. So I was like, you know what? Now was when I questioned myself, now what's my plan B? Now what am I going to do?
Right. What year was that?
I retired in 2010.
Okay.
So it's been 8 years.
Okay. So if you don't mind, I want to wrap this one up, and maybe we'll try to schedule time to do one more, and that'll get us from like 2010 to the present.
Okay.
All right? Because I think it's 2:30 or close to 2:30 anyway.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. So this wraps up the second interview with Rashard Griffith. Thank you.
No problem.
Okay. Today is March 30th, 2018. This is the third and final interview with Rashard Griffith. Again, we're here at the Kohl Center at UW-Madison, and my name is Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. So one more time, Rashard, like we did the other two times, if you could say your name and spell your last name.
Rashard Griffith, G-R-I-F-F-I-T-H.
Great, thank you. So before we turn this on, I was going to ask you a question about your time in Europe before we look at these last few years of your life.
Mm-hmm.
So you talked about how Chicago made you who you were, and how Madison has made you who you were. How did all that time you spent in Europe playing basketball, how did that help make who you are?
That contributed a big part in who I am today. When you come from Chicago, the area that I grew up in, and the stuff that I've been around and seen, it kind of hardens you in terms of your aspect, or if you don't never get outside of Chicago, like I know people that have never been outside the city limits, and Chicago is all they know. They don't, you know, they accept everything that's going on. I'm not talking about the bad. I'm not talking about any good things. I'm talking about all the shootings and the stuff that goes on, the closings of the schools and all this stuff. But this was going on for a long time since I was growing up. Like I said, I grew up in the projects. So then you go from Chicago, you come to Madison, and I think I mentioned it before, like you're like 2 hours away, and it's totally different. The people, the atmosphere, you know, you get people that walk by you and just don't know you to speak to you. You know what I'm saying? To hold the door open for you, take you in. And Europe was this the climax as far as I'm concerned with that, because every country that I played in Europe, a family like took me and my father in. And so what I mean by that is, started in Israel in 97. So we were over there, and this was my father's doing, because like I said, I'm an inside person. So I'm practice home, I go to the store, do what I need to do, but I'm back home. Not a party person or anything like that. I go do the events I need to do for my team, my autograph signings, or, you know, showing off the clothes that we got, or the cars, the auto shows and stuff that we have to do. So I would do that stuff, but then once again, it's right back home. My father was the one, he would go out and get lost, which was kind of dangerous, because I know for sure over in Israel, he went over there by one of those borders one time, and you know, they don't play. And so I told him, I said, you got to be careful. So he was scared, so that kind of slowed him down a little bit. But he ran into a family after the game, one of the games, and they were talking to him, and they were from Israel, but they lived between Israel and L.A. And so it was around Thanksgiving time, and my father was just like, what y'all got planned for Thanksgiving? I said, nothing. They gave us the day off, so I'm just going to sit down and chill. So he's like, well, we've been invited over to somebody's house to eat Thanksgiving dinner. I said, Pops, they don't celebrate Thanksgiving, Pops. He let know. He said, this family that father's a fan of yours, met him after the game, gave me his number, and we exchanged information, and he told me that they were throwing Thanksgiving dinner. And it's pretty much just for you. I'm like, you going to tell me this the day of? And so so we wound up going, and, you know, so Pops was like, we got to bring something, you know what I'm saying? So, but the thing was, you know, it's kind of hard because, you know, don't know them very well. So I was like, let this be in a bottle of wine or something like that or whatever. So we get over there and they was like, why did you buy this? They don't want you to buy anything. You know, it's just like, they don't care how much money you make or who you are. It's just like, you know, it was just about me and my father. And they took us in. And like every holiday, if they didn't even celebrate, it didn't matter. His wife cooked, his daughters cooked, and we went over there and we stood up there and had a feast. It was the same way when I was in Italy. Donatella, she's a fan of the team. She took us in, and she would always have these big dinners and stuff, and just invite us to players. And we would just all go over to her house and eat and whatnot. You know, she had this real nice 10-bedroom villa, and so we over there. And same thing in Romania. I call him Pops. My mixed martial arts instructor, Luciano, he did the same thing. When it was a holiday, I was over there. His wife would cook. Whatever she cooked, she made two. She made one for me to take home. So it was Easter. She made leg of lamb. So she made one for us to eat there and one for me to take back home with me. So I was just like, you know, every place that I've been that, you know, they sit there. I don't care if they had money or didn't have money. It didn't matter. Don't bring anything. Just bring yourself. You know, just come over here with a healthy appetite and let's have some good times. And the stuff, just the way things are done over there. But used to upset me is that I was over there for 17 years. And I have, to this day still, I have so many people tell me that they would never go to Europe. And I'm like, why? They're like, it's too dangerous. Dangerous in what way? Can you explain that to me? I said, yeah, the news shows all the bad stuff. They don't show the good stuff. I was in Israel and I rode by smoldering buses. I was in the middle of a rock fight, snapping, got hit by a rock. If they're targeting you, they're targeting you. You know what I'm saying? You're going to know they're targeting you. I'm on TV every day. So I'm like, they want to know or get me. They know where to come, you know, come find me at. But I was just like, I never, for the life of me, I couldn't understand people were just that terrified of, like, I would never go overseas. I would never go here. I would never go there and all that stuff. ISIS, I was over there in Turkey before ISIS really got big. I was over there when they were attacking buses and doing all this stuff or whatever. And now, like I said, I've seen all this stuff, and here I am. You know what I'm saying? My teammates, we're unharmed. It's primarily government officials that they're after. And, but it molded me, and it showed me that, you know, people of the world are not like the people in Chicago, per se. You know what I'm saying? The majority, I ain't gonna say all, but a lot of people in Chicago, they, like I said, they're set in their ways, not willing to broaden their horizons, not wanting to broaden their horizons. They're comfortable with being that. Hence is why they never crossed out of the state lines or don't want to go different places. And like I said, this is 2 hours away. And, you know, the difference between Chicago and Madison is huge to me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm talking about an inner city kid, but I'm comfortable up here. In Chicago, it's just like, you know, I walk outside, I'm looking around, I'm like, you know, making sure ain't nobody behind me. I don't want nobody behind me. When you're driving your car, you know, Madison got its problems or whatever, but it's nothing on the level as Chicago. And then Europe is the same. I mean, I've had situations where rushing into practice or tired from practice and going to the house and leave my car window down. A couple occasions for sure. And left my wallet in the car and phone and all that type of stuff. Come back out the next day, my stuff's still in my car. Let that happen in Chicago, 9 times out of 10, it's probably going to be gone. The whole car, probably. So, I mean, it just goes to show you the comfort level. Like when I found out in Italy that you couldn't get evicted, and I'm like, hold on, explain that to me. They was like, you don't have to pay your rent, and the landlord can't take your stuff like we do here and put it out on the curb. Because I was explaining them what they do in the States. If you don't pay your rent and you get evicted, you will come home and all of your belongings will be outside. They don't put you out in the wintertime. I was like, but if it's raining or whatever the case may be, your stuff is going to be outside on the street right there. And pretty sure some stuff will be gone, too, if you're not right there to, you know, supervise it. And I was just like, you don't know. And then I was just like, they so laid back. One young lady was telling me that she worked for United Colors of Benetton, told me she hadn't been paid in 6 months, and she still go to work. And she's like, oh, I know how I get paid. You know, I'm not worried about that. And I'm like, well, I guess you can be if you're not worried about not having to pay your rent and, you know, you're still working and, you know, they're feeding you and this, and that or whatever. And it's family-oriented, you know. Unless you are married, the parents, you can stay with your mother and your father till you my age, older, and I've seen it. So my son's mother, Cora, her brother lived with her mother, and he was older than me. So it's just like, I'm like, okay, no wife, no kids, no nothing, but you still live with your mother. I mean, well, I can understand that, you know, if you want to, you're a mama boy, you know, you want to look after your mother and stuff like that, but it's a lot. You know, the kids stay with their parents until they're, you know, they go and get married or have their own family. They do. If they don't, they stay with their family. And you don't see a lot of that here in the States. It's more like when you get 18, bye-bye. Mm-hmm. You know, hit the road, Jack.
Yep. Well, thank you for that, Richard. Mm-hmm. So when we left off Wednesday, you had retired from professional basketball, and you've been talking off and on about Plan B. Mm-hmm. And so it was now time for Plan B. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if you could try to walk me through how you transitioned from life as a basketball player to life not as a basketball player.
After I had my surgery on my Achilles, I was going through my rehab, and I actually had a contract to go back and play in Romania. We had just won a championship the year before. So I was going to go back and play, but as I was going through my workouts and I was training, and I was just like, you know, the body soreness and all this stuff, and I was just like, do I have it in me to go another year or two? And I kept asking myself that. And then I said, if I keep asking myself that, then the answer is no. Because I never asked myself that before. And I'm like, you're coming off a major injury, and, 36 years old, you went out on top, 17 championship. Then I started thinking about it, and I started looking as I was going through my workouts. I started looking because I was with the kids that were getting ready for the draft. So I'm with some younger kids and stuff, and they were always asking me questions and, wanting to play one-on-one and wanting me to teach them this and teach them that and how was this, how was that. So I said, okay. I always knew I wanted to give back. I knew that. I didn't know in what way. So once these kids started asking me questions and I started doing that, and then the guy that was training me at the time, he was like, Griff, he said, man, you'll make a good coach or a good trainer. So then I started thinking about it. So I started working with him. So I said, you know what? I called the team up and told them, I said, look, I'm just going to call it quits. I'm retiring. I'm done playing ball. You can avoid that contract. And, whatever. I'll see y'all when I come back over to see my son. That was it. And I told him that. And then I left. I pretty much just left it at that after that. And I was just like, okay, I started training kids, going around, going there. And what happened was I got tired of being lowballed. And what I mean by that is that it was several parents that come. See, I'm a type of guy, Troy, that I'm not sitting up there trying to break the bank with somebody. If you can afford, I can make the rates up, right? But how I try to change the game is, okay, you know what? I know everybody can't afford that. So I'm making it more about the kids. So what I'm going to do is I talk to the parents on an individual basis. These are the rates that we charge. And it wasn't nothing crazy. Like $250 will get you six sessions. So I'm like, I'm not breaking that down. But I want you to follow me on this, Troy. $250 will get you six sessions. These six sessions can be at your leisure. Whenever I'm training, when your six sessions up, if they come back again, that's another $250. So, and we go twice a week. So you think about it, you get your sessions in. If you back to back, for a few weeks or whatever. So that's almost a month right there. So $250 a month. Troy, I would sit down with people. I'm like, if you can't afford that, we can work something out. I have people paying $75 for six sessions. Some paying $100. Different. I'm like, this between me and you. You don't have to discuss what I do with everybody else. Now, here it is. I'm an accomplished athlete, high school, college professional. Know what I'm doing. And here it is. I can't figure out. I'm talking to my former partner, and I was just like, I'm trying to figure out, why are we always going behind somebody? And what I mean by that is, it was this one situation. This young lady, she had a women's basketball team. They were out in the suburbs of Chicago. Then they paid this guy, he's a white guy, trainer, $2,500 a month for a month, so $5,000 two months to train their child to get them ready for the basketball season, right? When it came time for them to go to practice, they were not in shape. The girls had trained with us before. The parents then called us and ask us for our help to get their child in shape and ready for the season with 3 weeks to go before the season get ready to start. So I'm sitting up there, we did it because it was about the kids. So we did it, but then I got upset, and I'm just like, when I found out how much the guy they were, I was talking to the parents, and I found out how much they were paying the guy that was training their kids before, and then how much they had paid us before, and how much they paying us now, there's no comparison. And I'm just like, why? I'm like, who is this guy? Did my research on him. Nothing special. This guy's degree in kinesiology or whatever. And if I'm not mistaken, that's just the study of movement of your body, if I'm not mistaken. So I'm just like, he has no experience in basketball. Never played basketball. I was just like, never been through it. So then I started telling the parents. I was just like, okay, so when your child comes to you and they say it's this, or they say this, or they going through this. I can, what we have is all inclusive. So when I have the kids train, my cousin is a certified trainer, professional trainer, former football player, NFL, you know, prospect, went to school, had an injury, went to school, got his degree, and all that stuff. My other cousin is a professional bodybuilder, same thing, licensed massage therapist, certified trainer, certified dietitian. I got all this under my umbrella. I got myself, I got my former partner. I got him doing the ball handling drills. I handle the kids from the 4 and the 5 or whatever. That's my area of expertise. You know, everybody do ball handling because of the way the game is. Everybody's gonna learn how to shoot the ball. I had a track coach, Laverne. She was our track coach. She worked on their vertical. She worked on their running gait, their running style to make them more fit. We got all this. I'm charging $250 a month now, Troy. But everybody set up there, and I was just like, okay, so is it that I don't got a degree? So I'm trying to figure out what. I got international players coming from Turkey, from over there spending months, 3 months with me to train. They asked me a question. They was just like, how long do you need for us to see visible results in our children? I said, 3 months. I said, if you want to see definite results, I need 3 months. I said, if you want to see a slight improvement, you can get that in 2 months. But definite improvement, body look, skill set, all that, 3 months. We went every day. They came over for 3 months. And we went every day from June. They got over at the beginning of June. They left it in August 31st, they left to go back to Turkey. All the kids, I had a cook, Chef Michael, cook. All their meals, if the kids follow what I'm telling them to do, they will get the results that you are asking for, and they got them. Hence why I've been dealing with them for 6 years. So I know what I'm doing. So now I was just like, okay, that wasn't a problem. I still got that relationship right now. But I couldn't figure out, after they left, my own people in Chicago, wherever, they wanted to set up their low balls. So I said, you know what? I said, maybe it's that I don't have a degree. So I said, I'm going to go and get my degree. I'm going to go work on me. Because I'm a firm believer that before you go into a relationship or a business deal or whatever the case may be, you yourself have to be together. Your stuff has to be together. You have to be together. So I'm like, you know what? Let me work on me some more and get that together. So I did that, from 2010 to get that 5 years, 2015. 2016, I was still doing that, but I was just like, you know, I was just like, you know what, I'm over all this other stuff. I need to do that. I came up here on that day for that game. Mm-hmm. And then I talked to Coach Alvarez, and that's when I came up here to go to school for this, get my degree. And so from 2010, after I had my surgery and figured I was going to retire, I just started training kids, young men and women, teaching them the importance of being a student athlete, and student comes first. That's why it's called student athlete. So I started just, you know, emphasizing that to them, because if you know kids, they sit there and they just want to play basketball or want to just play football, just want to play baseball, but they forget about the academic part of it. And I believe the smarter that you are in your classroom, the smarter that you are on the basketball floor, on the field, on the ice, wherever you may be, because your thought process, your brain, you're using your brain, you get the fire. The brain is so underutilized, it's, you know, it's amazing, but it's so powerful. And people have to understand that they have to tap into that, and they have areas in their brain they haven't tapped into, just like areas in their body that they haven't tapped into. And I have to tell them, you have to get comfortable with being uncomfortable. You have to get out of your comfort zone, because without any kind of pain is a great teacher. Because you think about it, you get hurt, you burn yourself on the stove. Hand messed up for a few weeks or whatever. I can guarantee you won't do that again, no time soon. You know, and stuff like that, you have to go. My sensei told me when I was doing karate, he had told me, he was just like, Griff, you got to come on down the Valley of Pain. And I'm like, I ain't got no problem. But he's like, no. He said, I'm going to take you to a different level of pain. He was just like, I'm going to take you someplace that you've never been physically and mentally. And then when you come back from that, you're going to be so much stronger than you realize. I'm going to teach you how to heal before I teach you how to hurt or kill somebody. So you're going to know both ends of the spectrum. You're going to know what it takes to make a life, save a life, take care of a life. And you're going to also learn how to, what it is to damage somebody, this, this, and that. Or whatever. I didn't understand that, but he explained every step of the way and why, and it was a method to everything that was going on. And that's I've been taught by these people. The same thing when I was with ballet. Homer told me the same thing. He said, I got to break you down to build you up. So you're going to have to go through some pain to get this. He said, because you never did this. So it's going to hurt. You never done it, like never before. So when he would take me and put me on my back and sit on my ankle, put my socks on, and have my foot to, so like you see my foot now, my foot will be flat with the ground, straight with the ground, just like that. But when I got through, I went through that pain, once I got healed up and everything, my footwork, my vertical, my side-to-side movement, he unlocked stuff that was locked up for years that I had no idea about. That was his job. He did that. He told me, you got to just take the pain. He said, I promise you, if you take the pain, you go through what you got to go through, you'll be better for it on the other end. And a lot of things that I've been through in my life have to do with pain. And the stuff, the way that I grew up, suffering through that, it's preparing me for life. And I tell people, I mean, for me, it's easy. When I see some stuff, and I think I mentioned to you before, when I see certain things going on or something that's not going to be beneficial or I don't want to be a part of, I can instantly just cut that off, and I'm gone, because I'm not going to deal with it. I don't have time for that, because I have a choice. I'm not going to deal with it. And these kids, I've seen something on TV, this choking game the kids play nowadays and stuff like that. See, I didn't play that type of stuff when I was growing up. So I'll be trying to figure out where these kids' heads at, and I'm learning stuff to try to learn how these kids, this generation, think. It's totally different. So I'm trying to, my goal and my job is to get these kids to understand that if you step outside your comfort zone and you work on that, you go through some pain, because we can't shelter our kids, Troy. I tell my son's mother right now, stop babying him. You can't baby him forever, first of all, number one. Number two, I was like, how is he going to know how it feels if a little girl breaks his heart, or you trying to protect him from falling down all the time or something like that or whatever? So when he gets older, it's just going to be that much worse. He doesn't know how to deal with things. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, that's life. Like, kids don't know how to jump over fences and stuff like that I'm pretty sure you did when you were growing up or whatever. Kids nowadays don't know how to do that. Like, you know how to jump a fence? What's that? Oh, okay. You know what? No problem. You don't know what it is. So it's just like, for whatever reason, people are afraid to make that jump. And what I mean by make that jump, so say, for instance, this is a cliff right here. I'm at the edge of this cliff. I'm in my comfort zone. I got my family. I'm making decent money, but won't need more because my family's growing. My kids are getting older, need more things. But all below me is ways that I can improve myself. But I do not want to take off. I got a parachute to stop it anytime I want. But I'm afraid to take that step and take that leap to see what's out there and see what's down there. And you'll never know unless you step out of it. Because the only thing you can do is tell me no. And I'm learning a lot by me being in school about nonprofit leadership from, you can't be afraid to ask for somebody to donate to your foundation or help you with your cause. The only thing they can do is say no. And then they might tell me no, but send me to somebody that might help me with my cause. And people don't understand that. So I understand the only thing you can do is tell me no, so I'm not afraid to ask for what I need, for what's needed, because I know it's bigger than me. I have no problem stepping outside my comfort zone. I can get comfortable being uncomfortable, because, basketball actually prepared me for that. Some of the situations that I was put in, some of the hostile environments I've been put in. I've been in places where I sit up there and, I've been hit with coins and You know, people throwing Coke bottles and chairs with concrete still they whipped up out of the ground on the floor while we playing and stuff like that. So I've been around the world. Europe prepared me for that, Chicago, and Madison. And I believe things come full circle. And I believe the relationship that you build in your life from a youth to your adulthood what's carry you through life. Because me, I didn't think that I would be back in Wisconsin working on getting my degree, because I asked myself that same question. I try to be that person to sit up there and say, okay, I practice what I preach. So I asked myself, what's my B plan? And my B plan would have been me owning my own business. So my business now is me starting my nonprofit leadership, getting my degree to back me up from one of the most prestigious universities in the world, and start my nonprofit as soon as I graduate, and still working for the university. So that's my plan B. If you ask me that, 2008 or whatnot, I own my own business. What? I didn't know. But I knew I wanted to be a business owner, and I know I wanted to give back and help out the communities. So, like I say, every city, Chicago, Madison, and when I played overseas, each country helped mold me into the person that I am today. And the people that were in my lives affected me in different ways, but they weren't on, even if it was a negative way, I learned from that. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? My ex, my daughter's mother, the stuff that I went through with her, I learned from that. You know what I'm saying? So it's just like, it's a learning process, but I appreciate the learning process, and everything was done for a reason, because I'm still here for a reason. So it was all done for a reason, and that's for me to, I believe, to give back, help people understand that, you know, you got to have a will, you got to have passion to what you want to do. And you have to be real with yourself. Because if you're not real with yourself, I mean, I asked the kids now, I asked Chuck before he got ready to leave, I said, what do you want to do? I said, so after your senior year, after your last game, your official game, what are your plans? He looked at me, I said, so I help you out. So do you want to continue to play basketball at the highest level after college? Do you plan on getting an internship somewhere, or have you done an internship somewhere? Do you have it lined up to, you know, go right into a job? TJ, Aaron, Aaron and Matt, they all get jobs when they get through when they graduate. Shoei got a job working at a bank. You know, Josh Gossel works in our business department here. So everybody has something to go to, because basketball is not going to be, if that's not it. And even if that is your choice, I play 17 years. That's relatively short in terms of, now my career is on what, now what? You know what I'm saying? Unless you are Michael Jordan or Kobe Bryant, and you've amassed this massive wealth and popularity around the world, then what are you going to do? So, you know, do you have something? Have you established businesses that you will help you live the life that you need to do? But not only your life, what about your kids and then your kids' kids? And so on. How are you going to help them to build and to grow? You know, so me, my goal is to start this foundation, my nonprofit foundation, and I want to leave this for my three children, and I want to get property amassed so they can sit there and they can grow, and this will be what they have to for their legacy to grow on. Mm-hmm. So that's my goal. So when I'm sitting up there at night and I'm tired, when I'm doing my homework and stuff like that, I think about them, and I'm like, okay, you know, I'm leading by example. You know, I'm walking down the street. I'm in class. I mean, you see me, so I'm in class. It's not like I'm sitting up there ditching or whatnot. I'm not thinking I'm better than the next man or the next woman. I'm sitting there, I'm doing my work, I'm grinding, because it's, for me, it's an appreciation. I appreciate it, because nothing's given, everything is earned.
Thank you. Maybe just one more thing, because mm-hmm. that really was a good wrap-up, but I want to make sure we get sort of officially the work. You talked about the classwork you've been doing and why you're doing that. Mm-hmm. Can we talk a little bit more about the work you've been doing for athletics? Because it sounds like it's both helping basketball players become better basketball players, but also trying to teach athletes how to be student athletes too.
That's pretty much almost like a mentor, Troy. because the rules being the way that they are, I couldn't get on the floor. So like right now they had me as a team manager. So because I'm in class and I'm taking a full load. So I'm on scholarship, taking a full load, so I'm considered to be a manager. So now I'm able to get out there with the kids and, you know, put the pad on them and help them with moves and stuff like that. They can call me up, like, Griff, can we get in the gym? I'm like, yeah. When I first got here, I couldn't do that. The rules stated that you couldn't have, it's like giving the kids special privileges. So what I just did is, I'm talking to you, I would just have conversations with them. You know what I'm saying? I would tell them the truth, what I see from my point of view, without nothing coming from the coaches or whatever. I just tell them the truth, from a Nigel to a Vito Brown to whoever. I would just tell them, I'm like, dude, look, this is what you need to do. You got to do blah, 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 blah. Now my role has expanded because now I'm able to get out there. I was in practice every day last year, too. So that wasn't the problem. But the rule, the NCAA rules was the problem. So now it's more expansive. And then once I get my degree, I will be they have to figure out a way to keep the role the same. You know what I'm saying? Because now I got my degree, I graduated, so now I'm not a student anymore. So then they have to find a title to give me that's going to allow me to do the same thing. But I would also be well with the athletic department, like on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Me and Ron Dane, we go help John Detman train the athletic department. So a bunch of athletic department people, they come down and we got them from 11:45 to 12:15, no, 11:30 to 12:15. We train them in, you know, physical exercise. Because you'll be amazed, and I don't know, you might have been through this yourself, that you can be in the office. If this is our office, this is my cubicle, your cubicle's right there, and I might not even know you. Might not know your name, unless I need to know your name. So, and it's like you go by, I might speak to you and everything, no problem. You speak to me and everything. But you don't know who you really are, what you do, or you don't know who I really am or what I do. So it's two part. The healthier you are, the more cognitive you are, the better you can work, the better you feel. And also to get them to knowing each other and being around each other. So we do that on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Me, Ron, and JD. We do that. So those are my roles right now, besides going to school. Those are my jobs.
Okay. Rashard, anything else you want to say before we wrap this up?
No, I appreciate your time and being able to get this out. It actually started some ideas for me thinking about, like, I want to do a book. I'm definitely going to do a documentary and some other things that I got planned. Coming up. So yeah, just got the ball rolling, and you just showed me a way. I believe every day you can learn something new. So
I appreciate the time you gave me too. So this concludes the oral history with Rashard Griffin. Thanks again.